The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. In honor of Pearl Harbor Day and our military members, the first story I want to read for you is titled, On the Way Home. December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, marked the attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese and the entrance of the United States into World War II. Sometime later, in the town of South Beach, Staten Island, New York, the family of Nicholas D. Venero received the dreaded telegram of the day. It read, "You are drafted." It was March 29, 1944, and Dad was soon assigned to the U.S. Army 71st Infantry Division in the European Theater. I was only 2 years old, and my brother Frank was six. 2 months after Dad was drafted, the Army deferred all fathers with two children. Dad missed that cutoff by 2 months. Dad went to Europe and was a member of an assault platoon near Speyer, Germany. On April 3, 1945, while under heavy fire, he was wounded while helping an injured comrade. We were told the hospital ship carrying my father, Private First Class D. Venero, back to New York, was involved in a hurricane off the Azores Islands. Mom got a telegram saying Dad was believed to be lost at sea. Our family was devastated. 1 week later, we were informed Dad was in a hospital in England, recuperating from a wound in his left forearm. Later on, when our mother and our Uncle Vincent went to pick him up at Fort Dix, New Jersey, he wasn't there. Where could he be? They came home, and lo and behold, Dad was standing in our living room with tears in his eyes and his arms outstretched. Mom was looking at him in shock. Among many tears, hugs, and kisses, Dad was home. Dad received the Bronze Star for action in Germany on March 26, 1945. He also received the Purple Heart for wounds sustained as a result of enemy action. He is enrolled in the Purple Heart Museum in New Windsor, New York. Our story ended happily, but many brave men and women did not come home. God bless, and thanks to all those who gave the ultimate sacrifice. And this story is submitted by Madeline D. Venero, Incan. And in honor of the holidays that we'll celebrate in December, I do have some stories to share with you. The first one is submitted by Dave Borowski, and it's titled, A Kielbasa Tradition. When I was a boy growing up in a Polish family in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, in the late 1950s and 60s, we had a Christmas tradition of smoking kielbasa, popularly known as Polish sausage. It was a big job that started weeks before the holiday. Even in early December, winter had already arrived in northeastern Pennsylvania. The leaves were off the trees and snow had already dusted the ground on several occasions. Kielbasa production was a family affair. My grandmother and mother would shop for the ingredients at Kozel's Butcher in the neighborhood. There was the pork, plus seasonings like garlic, marjoram, and salt. Traditionally, kielbasa was made from pork, but in the 1960s, beef was introduced by the Polish government. How they got involved, I don't know. So then my family added beef, too. There was an important side dish included in the tradition, grated horseradish. My mother made the horseradish dish from scratch. She went to the grocer's and picked out the best-looking horseradish roots, washed them, and grated them. She cried during the creation of this marvelous side dish. Like onions, horseradish gives off an eye irritant. Plain horseradish was always considered much too strong for human consumption, so Mom mixed in red beets, and everyone enjoyed the toned-down delicacy. My grandfather would grind the pork and beef and then mix in the seasonings. Then he'd shove the mixture into pig intestines, clean and salted, of course, and produce a dozen or so sausages for us and for neighbors and other family members. Down the street from our house and across Cole Street was a small woods. My grandfather, father, and I would continuously roam the woods throughout the year looking for downed apple tree limbs to bring back to the house to dry in preparation for the kielbasa smoking. The smoker was an old white refrigerator that had its insides torn out. Thick wooden dowels had been placed inside the eviscerated appliance to hold the rings of raw kielbasa. My job was to watch and care for the applewood fire. The fire had to be mostly smoke, so it took a long time. Hours. I would switch off watching it with my grandfather and occasionally with my father. We lived in a double block, in other cities called a duplex, so my grandparents were just steps away. Kielbasa smoking season was cold, and there was a wood stove in the shanty where we sat and got warmed. I would watch the fire for a while, and then Grandpa would spell me while he smoked cigarettes. My grandmother didn't like the fact that Grandpa smoked, so the apple wood smoke was a smoke screen, so to speak, although I think Grandma knew what Grandpa was up to. The sausages had to be smoked for a long time. It's called cold smoking. It was cold, I can attest to that, and it was memorable fun. It was even more fun when it snowed. And the next story I have for you is submitted by Barbara Tevin, and it's titled Christmas Season Starts with Songs. Like most kids, my brothers and I knew that the day after Thanksgiving was the official start of the Christmas season. Long before Mom baked her Swedish bagels and Spritz cookies, and days before we bought our Christmas tree, my older brother Rex and I knew how to kick things into high gear with music. And what music it was. We retrieved Dad's stacks of Christmas albums from the living room cabinet, and soon the songs of the most popular artists of the 1950s and early 1960s were roaring through the speakers. Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Ella Fitzgerald, Nat King Cole, Rosemary Clooney, Chet Atkins, Perry Como, Percy Faith, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. The list goes on. My favorite albums were Ferrante and Teacher's Snowbound, followed by Christmas with Conniff. I remember playing the Christmas Bride track over and over. Dad was an Iowa farm boy and a World War II pilot. He owned a recording studio in downtown Minneapolis, Mark Lee Productions, which served the commercial needs of local TV and radio stations. Although not a musician himself, he appreciated well-recorded music. He often came home with an armload of new stereophonic, high-fidelity albums, which he would log in a little book and then label. Dad was not exactly obsessive-compulsive, but he was fastidious about keeping records and logbooks. Mom always said it was because he was grounded from flying due to health reasons. Even on road trips, his detailed logbooks were legendary. He recorded what time the car stopped, how many miles were driven since the last stop, how much gas was used, and even what we ate at the cafe. He always used two Parker pens conveniently housed in his pocket protector, designating red ink for the mileage and blue ink for the meals and other details. When we moved to our 1920s bungalow in 1962, Rex was 13 and I was 10. The house's lack of wall space for Dad's sound equipment frustrated him until he came up with an ingenious solution. He hung a complete stereo system on a custom metal cage and screwed it to a piano hinge on the tiny wall space between the front closet and the front door. The hinge allowed the audio components to swing out to facilitate modifications and repair. Rex and I, and eventually our kid brother Mark, quickly learned how to push the mini buttons to operate the amplifier, tuner, radio, reel-to-reel tape player, and turntable. We were schooled in the correct terms. It wasn't a record player. It was a turntable. It wasn't a needle. It was a stylus. We knew that we should never blow on the stylus, but use a tiny brush to clean the delicate edges free of any dust. Handling record albums required more training. We were to remove records from their dust jackets only by the rim, as a fingerprint on a track invited trouble. With great care, we returned records to the library in the appropriate order. Dad's record collection included Broadway and motion picture soundtracks, classical music, and, of course, big band and American standards recordings from most of the same artists on the Christmas albums. To carry the sound effectively, Dad placed huge custom-built speakers on either side of the piano. He let us play records as loud as we wanted. When my Beatles album arrived in 1964, well, that was really something to hear. Our old house really rocked. Dad's background in electrical engineering provided all kinds of other fun. For instance, when one of us entered the bathroom and closed the door, the radio turned on. He also rented a film projector one Christmas so he could show us a silent Laurel and Hardy short, Big Business, about selling Christmas trees in California. Dad loved all things Laurel and Hardy. We often gathered around the television on Sundays to watch their escapades. Once in a while, the recording studio became a fun Saturday destination. Rex and I, and occasionally some friends, would take the bus downtown to record an album of music and funny commercials in the voice booth. In the mid-1960s, Dad bought us cassette players for Christmas, which were still uncommon at that time. In the 1970s, Dad purchased one of the first VCRs available, of course. When I went off to college in 1970, Dad recorded Letters from Home on cassette tapes for me. I remember coming home that first Christmas break. After eating my requested favorite meal of mac and cheese, sliced ring bologna, and soft rolls with strawberry jam, I took out Snowbound from the record cabinet. When the music hit the air through that wonderful sound system, I knew I was home and that it was Christmas. There was no better feeling in the world. We lost Dad much too early at age 60, but he left all of us a love of good music and a lot of organizational skills. I still play Snowbound and the other Christmas classics each year to kick off the season. Our next story is about a traditional Christmas food, and it is simply titled Fruitcake. As a child in Barrington, Rhode Island in 1964 and every other year of the early 1960s, I thought of Thanksgiving as a day to get through. The roast turkey, mashed rutabagas and potatoes, green bean casserole, and pumpkin and mincemeat pies were delicious, and I had fun with my cousins from out of town. But the excitement of the day lay not so much in the company or the food as it did in the fact that when it was over, we could clear the decks for Christmas. I started the season by opening the pages of the Sears catalog to the toy section and making my list. While I wore out the pages in the toy section, and my list grew much longer than Santa would allow, my mother made her annual fruitcakes using the same recipe each year. The recipe was titled White Fruitcake, and true to its name, Mom's loaves were light in both color and texture, not dark and dense like most fruitcakes. These were studded with just the right amount of fruit and nuts. I didn't pay too much attention to exactly how she did it, but after mixing the ingredients, she poured the batter into loaf pans and baked them for a long time, taking up the whole oven and filling the house with the aroma of spices and fruit. Once cooled, she wrapped the loaves in brown paper, tied them with string, and put them in the attic to age. During the daytime on Christmas Eve, she loaded them in a big cardboard box in the back of our wood-paneled station wagon and drove around town, stopping to deliver one at the home of each friend and acquaintance on her list. While fruitcake has been around for centuries in various forms in different cultures, America's version came to our shores with the British colonists, so the recipe stems from their tradition, where it was called Christmas cake or plum cake. According to my research, Part of fruitcake's popularity in the past was due to its legendary shelf life, which was important in the time before home refrigeration. Essential to the longevity of the cakes was brushing them periodically with distilled spirits as they aged in a cool, dark place for up to 2 months. To this day, the traditional spirit of choice to add to fruitcakes is brandy, but rum is also popular, or if you're in the South, bourbon. Did my mother add rum or brandy to the batter to help them age in the attic? I don't know. At a minimum, she must have gone up to the attic during the month they were up there aging, unwrapped them, and brushed them with some manner of spirits. I'll never know because the recipe she wrote out for me doesn't include any mention of liquor, and Alzheimer's was just starting to steal her from us at that time. When she was making and distributing them every Christmas Eve, fruitcake was a popular Christmas tradition. In addition to the colonial custom of dousing fruitcakes with alcohol to extend their shelf life, they contained fruit that had been preserved from the summer harvest for use in the winter. To eat fruit year-round during colonial times, it was cut into small pieces, boiled in sugar syrup, tossed in granulated sugar, and allowed to dry. It was no doubt tastier back then. Today, it is much maligned and misunderstood, perhaps because most of the fruitcakes available now, through mail order or in grocery stores, are dark and heavy enough to be doorstops, and they are laden with dyed red and green candied cherries. My mother's fruitcake recipe featured dried apricots, pineapple, dates, and raisins, as well as coconut and nuts such as slivered almonds and walnuts. Over the years, after my siblings and I left home for lives of our own, our mother continued to make her recipe and would send us each half a loaf right after Thanksgiving. Though she had given up aging it, her fruitcake never disappointed. In fact, it got better. After my parents moved from Rhode Island to California in the early 1980s, the ingredients were even fresher. It was in the 1990s when I asked her for the recipe. I planned to make it then, but I never got around to it, with kids still at home and a full-time job. I'm hoping that by restarting the tradition of making fruitcake will be a special way we can remember Mom. I will honor and remember her with fruitcake. After scouring the internet for a good recipe, I have found one that I will combine with elements of her recipe, and I hope to start a fruitcake tradition of my own. Better late than never. And the story is submitted by Lee Stevens. And now I have some short stories to share with you from the Bits and Pieces section. And the first one is called Christmas is Past by Carol Alexander. I come from a large Italian family, and we knew how to celebrate Christmas. We would gather at my grandmother's, the entire clan of aunts, uncles, and cousins of all ages. I remember one particular Christmas Eve when I was about 6 or 7 years old. My cousin Stanley and I were patiently waiting for Santa's arrival. No, Grandma didn't have a fireplace for Santa to come down, but her house had an upstairs and an ample staircase. We were sure that was good enough. We just knew that Santa would come down the stairs eventually, and we knew we would be able to open presents. We could hardly contain our excitement. Then the moment came. We heard stomping coming from upstairs and the sound of jingle bells. We knew it had to be Santa's sleigh and reindeer. Then there was Santa. He was coming down the stairs. Cousin Stanley and I were mesmerized. We remarked to each other that wasn't it strange that Santa had the exact same mole on his face as Stanley's father, my Uncle Dick. But that's as far as we could conceptualize this strange coincidence. To our delight, Santa, also known as Uncle Dick, continued this ritual for many Christmases to come. Many things have changed over the years since that long-ago Christmas of 1949. My large family is no more. They are all long gone. But I will always remember Christmas Eve at my grandmother's house and the joy of childhood innocence. And then Carl Smith submits our next story, which is titled, That Spanish Photographer. In June 1966, I was assigned to the Polaris missile submarine USS Sam Rayburn as a member of the Gold Crew. We were in Rota, Spain, preparing the ship to depart on another deterrent patrol. Although the crews, Blue and Gold, lived in Charleston, South Carolina, the ship itself operated from Rota during this time. Our rough schedule was to fly over to Spain to relieve the Blue crew, do a 30-day refit, a 60 to 70-day submerged patrol, get relieved by the Blue crew, and then return to Charleston. One day that month, I was with two of my shipmates on Liberty in the nearby town of Jerez. As we walked through one of the public plazas, we noticed an older fellow with what looked like a homemade camera mounted on a tall tripod. He was for hire, taking photos by request of passersby. We decided we'd give it a go. We posed side by side for him, and then he turned on his magic. Using the same wooden box he had just used to take our photo, he stuck his hand inside the box through a flexible sleeve, and occasionally looking inside, he actually developed the photo and made one print from, I assume, a negative. Using that print, which he mounted on a bracket in front of the lens, he proceeded to make a total of 3 wallet-sized prints, one for each of us. I don't recall how long all this took, but as we walked away, each of us was holding a memory of that day and that guy. While he was making the copies, I took his photo. I'm not even sure I would believe the story without that as proof. The next story I have for you is titled, Caroling in the 1940s, and this is submitted by Jewel Johnson. I was raised in Kennedy, Minnesota, where the winters were long and bleak. Even though we had no television to entertain us on those long winter evenings, there was plenty for kids to do. In that cold, dark season, we could go ice skating, since some kind soul had hung a light over the pond. Or on Monday nights, we could listen to Lux Radio Theater. But in December, instead, 5 of us got together in the evenings to sing Christmas carols for our neighbors. One particular evening, after we had sung for Widow Sorvik, the Bingstons, and Ben Nelson, we stopped under a streetlight to decide where we'd sing next. After a long pause, Marilyn said, "How about singing for Mr. Blake?" We peered into the darkness to see the outline of the Blake Mansion on a hill a half mile from where we stood. It was strange that it had never occurred to us to venture beyond our neighborhood, and we certainly had not thought to sing for the proprietor of Blake's Mercantile. "It's pretty far up there," I said, studying the winding lane to the mansion. "And Mr. Blake's hard of hearing," Earl chimed in. "Besides, he never goes to church," Bobby added. "He doesn't even like Christmas carols." We had overheard our parents speculate on the reasons why Mr. Blake didn't darken the church door. Some said it was because he was too deaf to hear the preacher. Others thought the town's only millionaire was excused from ordinary things like church going. "If we sing for him, maybe he'll give us a candy bar." Mary Ann's high-pitched voice pierced the chilly air. She patted her red mittens together, pleased to come up with the idea. Every child in town knew Mr. Blake often handed out free chocolate bars to children in his stores on Saturdays. So that cold night, 5 of us started up the snow-packed lane. The Blake Mansion stood apart from the town, situated on a 5-acre tract. Surrounded by giant cottonwoods, elms, and maple trees, the bare branches now creaked and swayed in the night. Snow-covered hedges stood like white sentinels in the pale starlight. We stood under a window where a light shone. Do you think he'll hear us? Bobby asked, raising his eyes to the window. No, but Mrs. Rustad, his housekeeper, will, I said. We stood knee-deep in snow and sang, O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. When the last note of the song faded, we waited, expecting to see a face in the window. No one appeared. Let's try Joy to the World, Bobby said, stomping his feet to keep warm. We can get loud on that. We strained our voices all the while, craning our necks for a glimpse of Mr. Blake. He can't hear us, I sighed. We turned to find our way back to the road. Children, children, would you like to come in and sing for Mr. Blake? Mrs. Rustad appeared in the shadows, hugging a pink sweater around her checkered house dress. Yes, we shouted. Hopping over the snowdrifts like Arctic kangaroos, we pushed our way toward the back entrance of the mansion. Mrs. Rustad led us into a small, unheated room. Wait here, she said. Soon the door swung open and the old man, wearing a gray suit and vest, stepped into the room. You came to sing for me? He asked. Mr. Blake's stern gray eyes swept over us, and we nodded. What are your names? He pointed a finger at Bobby. Bobby Carlson. This is my little sister. She's six. He nodded toward Mary Ann. Speak louder, children, Mrs. Rustad said. Mr. Blake is hard of hearing. Earl's my name, Earl shouted, and this is Marilyn and Jewel, he pointed at us. Mr. Blake adjusted his hearing aid, cupped his right hand over his ear, and fixed his eyes on the linoleum. It was time to sing Joy to the World, the Lord is come. We sang with all our might, then softly we sang Silent Night and O Little Town of Bethlehem. We finished singing, and Bobby said, Well, we'll be going. Four of us shuffled toward the door. Suddenly, Mr. Blake leaped into action. Wait, he shouted. Wait a minute. He disappeared through the door. Soon we heard footsteps, and Mr. Blake sprang into the room. In his hand, he had a brown box of candy bars. Each of us thanked him. We couldn't have been happier if we'd been presented with a new toboggan. Wasn't that nice of him? Mary Ann's shrill voice echoed in the still night. I sure like Mr. Blake. Let's sing, Bobby yelled. Joy to the world. The Lord has come. He waved his arms in the air. We joined in. Let every heart prepare him room, and heaven and nature sing. We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
Howdy, folks. Yes, it is your old friend Singin' Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?